I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Dominique Browning wrote a piece titled Let's Celebrate the Art of Clutter in the New York Times recently that caught our eye. She was pushing back against the message that says it's time to get rid of all the stuff you've accumulated over the years. It's time to unburden yourself and simplify your life. She said, no way. And she wrote, I'm not done with living. I'm not done with my things. I love them. In fact, more and more each year as I recollect the journey that brought us together, I will cherish them till death do us part. Well, we wanted to know more and asked her to join us on Radio Times. She's a writer. She's an author. She blogs at Slow Love Life. Formerly editor-in-chief of House and Garden, she's written for a number of other publications as well. And Dominique Browning, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Also with us is Linda Samuels. She's the president of the Institute for Challenging Disorganization. She's a professional organizer and coach and wrote a book called The Other Side of Organized. Linda Samuels, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here with both you, Marty, and with you, Dominique. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Dominique, let me begin with you. Who was telling you or where did you get the message that you needed to declutter?
Oh, there are numerous books. Most recently, one purporting to describe the Japanese art of decluttering, essentially. Numerous books, numerous magazine articles. I mean, this is a staple of the trade. I must say, guilty myself, published quite a few of them in my lifetime.
Well, are you a messy person? I mean, as the former editor of House and Garden, everything in that magazine looks so perfect. So I'm trying to understand what your place looks like.
I am not a messy person, although in the course of a week, I'll pull books down off the shelf and pull out the teapot and cups and things like that. And I do have to go through and have a reorganization from time to time. But, you know, clutter is a bit misleading. I'm not advocating that we bury ourselves in our stuff, nor that we let it get out of control. But I do have a lot of things.
Right. I mean, a lot of things that, as you say, sort of every week you have to sort of organize yourself and organize them back into where they belong?
No, that's sort of the course of living. And you don't put every book back on the shelf. I'm looking at a stack of 20 books on Japanese gardening right now. I'm not reading 20 at the same time, but that's what I'm diving into. No, everything has its place. I find new places for the various things that I bring home. I'm still buying things.
Right.
So, no, not messy. I think organized, serene, definitely. I believe in having things well organized and knowing where to go for them. But I'm definitely not into a minimalist lifestyle.
Well, Linda, let me get you in on the conversation. And,
sure.
You know, I sometimes wonder whether we get to a certain point in our life. We've lived a number of decades and we have accumulated things over the years. And sort of looking at one's stuff or our stuff, say, you know, do I really need this jacket that I haven't worn in 10 years? Are we sort of overloaded with stuff, do you think?
Are we overloaded with stuff? Well, you know, it's a great question because it's actually an individual question. What too much stuff feels like to one person is completely different to another. So, you know, the idea, like when you look at the extremes, you know, minimalism versus hoarding, right? Those are the two extremes. And as Dominique wrote about in her article, most of us are somewhere in the middle.
Right.
But even within that middle, what feels like too much for one is very different from what it feels like for another. And you see that not just with the individual, but within a household. You know, there are different styles of what clutter looks and feels like and what we're comfortable with.
I would say so. And at the same time, sometimes it seems like it's important sometimes to kind of take stock of what we have and try to figure out, does that really mean to me what it meant to me when I first bought it 25 years ago? How should we think about things like that, Linda? And then I'll put the same question to you, Dominique.
Well, I think when you think about what our lives are, you know, our lives are a process, right? We start with basically nothing, and then we begin to accumulate. We accumulate things. We accumulate the memories that are attached to those things. We accumulate feelings around the stuff, the emotional attachments, and then we go through natural courses of transitions in our time, you know, life transitions. We move, we have children, we get divorced, we change jobs, we experience the loss of loved ones. And all of these things change the stuff that's in our lives. We either the letting go or the accumulating more. So it's part of what is a natural process of our lives to be looking at our stuff at not every single moment,
right,
but at periods of time to say, are the things that are in my life, are they meaningful still? Are they supporting who I am, what I'm trying to do, or are they getting in the way of who I am now? And I think, you know, and that's in all areas, whether it's paper, books, clothes, collections, it affects every area.
Dominique, are there certain things that you have that just mean so much to you?
I just want to say, Linda, that was so beautifully put. I totally agree. Life is such a process, and so is the accumulation. Yes, there are things that I'm looking at right now on my desk that my sons made for me in kindergarten 25 years ago, that I am never going to let go of, or souvenirs of a trip that I took that still are wonderful to me. So there are things that hold their magic, and there are things that you know immediately you want to get rid of as you're getting rid of the person who gave them to you. So, you know, that happens. And you know, different things, I think, hold different magic for us. Clothing is kind of a different category in the sense that we do outgrow our clothing. It's odd. I'm turning 60 this year, and I find that I am dressing really a different way than I did 20 years ago, 10 years ago. So there is a process of letting, you know, shedding as you get older and as you move through life that is necessary.
To you, Linda, I want to pick up on that because I think all of us have looked in our closet, and I have things that have been there, you know, 10, 20, even more years. I haven't worn them in a long time, but I can't give them up because they have memories for me. Maybe the memories of when I used to be able to fit into them.
I totally relate to that, Marty. I remember I kept for years. I don't know. I had this bikini. It was a favorite bikini, and my body changed after children. No longer was going to fit in that bikini. I mean, there was not even a hope and a prayer, but I could not get rid of it. And I remember the day when I finally let it go, because it was saying, you know, yes, maybe one day, one point in your life, you could wear it, but it's not happening, and you're here now. And so move forward. And so I know in my own closet, I like to keep clothes that fit, that I feel good in. I do have a few memorabilia pieces of clothing, but they're not in my prime closet. They're stored away, you know, some whatever. But because what happens is when you go to get dressed, for example, and you have things in there that are from another time that don't fit, sometimes they make us feel bad. If they are, in fact, you know, bringing up a positive memory, then maybe that's something else. And then that's in the category of keeping the things around us that lift us up, you know, that make us feel good. But I think keeping things around that don't make us feel good, that just takes away from the positive energy that we could have during any given day.
Makes sense to you, Dominique?
Yeah, same. The flip side of that story, the bikini story, is I have a suit that I've had for a couple of decades that I absolutely adore. It's very fancy. My son got married last year, and I knew immediately I wanted to be at the wedding in that suit. I just wanted to add yet another memory to that piece of clothing. It didn't even occur to me to go out and shop for something new. It still fit. I loved it, and I wanted to imbue it with more memory. So it's just an odd psychological and kind of magical way of thinking that your stuff carries history.
Absolutely.
Your stuff does carry history.
Yeah, go ahead, Linda.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely does. And I think that, you know, in the with the types of clients that I work with, they generally are more challenged with disorganization than most. And what we see is that the attachment to stuff is deep. So what someone else might just easily let go of, we find that is much harder with this population. And there are memories embedded in our stuff, and that's why it makes it hard to let go. And you don't necessarily have to let go. I mean, no one, you know, we don't come in as organizers and say, you have to let go of your stuff, or I hope our industry isn't going into our clients' house and saying that. We're trying to help people hold on to the treasures and release the stuff that is in the way, whatever in the way means to them.
And Linda, we have to say goodbye to you in just a couple of minutes, but I'm curious about some of the work that you might do with couples where you have, you know, the neat person married to the messy person, or the person that can't let go of that T-shirt that they had when they were in seventh grade and the one that's sort of tossing things willy-nilly. How do you negotiate between two very different people when it comes to their stuff?
You need to set a lot of boundaries and you know, help them to set boundaries and to set up sort of communal areas and personal areas, so that there's a sort of respect rules within the communal areas, and then in the personal areas, you know, that individual has the opportunity to fully express themselves as they need to. That helps for a lot of harmony in households.
And the idea that you can shut the door on that, right?
Exactly. Shut the door or whatever. I mean, it could, you know, sometimes it's not a whole room that someone's going to have. Sometimes it's an area of a room or a section of a closet. But, you know, to have a space, whatever that space is, where you really can just be who you are, very important.
Are you a neat person by nature, Linda?
I would say yes, I am, but I live in a household, I mean, now our daughters are grown, but we grew up in a household with them where everyone had different styles, and it was a matter of, you know, trying to balance those styles out, and most homes I go into, everyone's not the same.
Very carefully chosen words. And yeah. I wonder, too, whether, you know, people get to a certain point in their life where they think, okay, I really do need to downsize because we're not going to be living here anymore. And oftentimes it's when kids move out and all of a sudden parents are looking around and saying, you know, we don't need three or four bedrooms. We need something smaller.
Absolutely. You know, we see that a lot. In our industry, we talk about at a certain stage of life, depossessing. You know, we spend a lifetime accumulating, and then in the end we're depossessing. And, you know, I work with a lot of elders, which are in that position. And quite an interesting process.
Well, Linda Samuels, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And she's the president of the Institute for Challenging Disorganization. She's also a professional organizer and coach, wrote a book called The Other Side of Organized. Dominique Browning's going to stay with us for the rest of the hour. She's a writer. She's an author. She wrote a piece in the New York Times recently that caught our eye about clutter. It was titled Let's Celebrate the Art of Clutter. Got us thinking about our stuff and what we think about our stuff. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation with her, and also welcome Randy Frost to join us. He's a psychologist, has been studying hoarding. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Barbara Brodsky Suites at Lankenau Medical Center support WHYY and offer a new option in private overnight hospital accommodations. Each suite features a private living and dining area and personalized amenities for a tranquil and home-like environment that complements Lankenau's clinical care. With concierge services and gourmet dining options, the Barbara Brodsky Suites are a novel alternative to traditional hospital accommodations. To take a virtual tour, mainlinehealth.org/Brodsky.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about our stuff, why we keep it, what it means to us, and what to do with it when we don't want it. And again, Dominique Browning, our guest, she's a writer, author, formerly editor-in-chief of House and Garden, wrote an article recently in the New York Times about some of the things and clutter in her house, although she says it's not cluttered the way we might think of clutter in terms of mess. Joining us now is Randy Frost. He's the Harold and Elsa Cipolla Israel Professor of Psychology at Smith College and a hoarding expert. He's written numerous scientific articles and chapters on hoarding and related topics. Wrote a best-selling book a couple of years ago. In fact, was a guest on the show talking about the book and the book called Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding and the Meaning of Things. And Randy Frost, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We want to know how you think about the possessions that you have, your act of accumulating over the years. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Rainey, we've been talking about just the stuff that average people collect and how we can have a suit that means so much to us or a collection of teapots that means so much to us, and it might even be hard for us to give this stuff away. How is that similar and different from hoarding?
Well, one of the most fascinating things about a problem like hoarding or hoarding disorder is that it is really no different. The meaning of things for people with hoarding problems are really no different than the meaning of things for the rest of us. It's just that meaning gets extended to so many more things, and the feelings and the beliefs associated with possessions get more rigid. But for all of us, possessions have a magical quality. They connect us to the world in ways that are somewhat ethereal. So that ticket stub from a favorite concert, right, there's nothing about that ticket stub, the physical characteristic of that ticket stub, that's any different than any other ticket stub like it. It's just the association that we've placed on it. It's like we've taken our memories and our emotions and we've put them into that ticket stub. And then when we want to retrieve them, we go to the ticket stub and look at it. And it's like a key that unlocks that memory. And that is what happens with people with hoarding disorder in an exaggerated way.
And for you, we've been talking about some of the things that we have accumulated over the years. Are there certain possessions that you have, Randy, that have some of that meaning, like that ticket stub?
Certainly. Lots of different possessions. Things from when my kids were small, things from when I was in high school, and so forth. So lots of things like that.
Dominique, part of your article, you say whether your children like this or not, but you would like them to have all your stuff. And it is interesting, the thought of giving away the things that have meant so much to us and whether it's going to have the same value and meaning to the person that we either will them to or give them to. Help us understand your thinking behind that.
You know, I think that what I'm really dealing with is mortality. And I hope I have many, many more years left on this planet. But I have started thinking about what will the world be like when I'm gone. In my professional life now, I run an organization called Moms Clean Air Force, where we are fighting climate change as a children's health issue. So I'm spending a lot of time thinking about what kind of world are we leaving behind on a global scale. So on an intimate scale, I've started wandering around my house thinking, oh, Alex would love that photograph, or Theo would love that teapot. And really what I'm thinking about is, how are they, what is their life going to be like when I'm not here, and how can I still be part of it?
And are the things that relatives or maybe your parents or grandparents that have given you that you have held on to that as part of that same memory and connection?
There are a few things like that, although I hate to say it, but I think our ancestors did not collect as much stuff as we did. You move into an apartment in a New York City building, and the closets are probably a fraction of the size of what was needed in the year 1900 when the building was made. People didn't have the kind of access to such inexpensive consumer goods as we do, and they didn't travel the world the way we do. So possessions were probably much harder to come by, and people didn't have as many as they do now.
And Randy Frost, you think that's a problem for us? The fact that we can accumulate so much means that we do, and then we don't know what to do with it?
I think that is exactly one of the difficulties we face now. If you look at the storage industry, self-storage and other storage industry over the past 40 years has been a really booming business. Our ancestors had relatively small living spaces. Our living spaces are big. We've got garages, attics, basements, and even that isn't enough to handle all of our stuff. But it raises some interesting questions, though, about the meaning that our possessions have for us. So if we have a lot of possessions, how much meaning, how intense is the emotional meaning for all of those possessions as opposed to our ancestors who had relatively few, and what meaning those possessions have for them? And I think what's happened is that we've sort of spread out the emotional meaning our possessions have to include lots of different ones.
Saying that the feeling is not quite as intense because we have so much and we sort of have to spread the feeling among all our things.
Exactly. It dilutes it in a sense. It dilutes that ability. And one of the things we find with people who have hoarding disorder is a strange kind of difficulty where they have emotional meanings. They have attachments to all the things that they acquire and save. But because of their inability to manage the possessions, once the possession is in their home, it virtually never gets used and never gets looked at. And the only time it's dealt with is when they somehow have to face the possibility of getting rid of it. And then there is emotional distress associated with it. So it's a sort of funny problem for people with hoarding disorder because it's like they're collecting all these things that have meaning and that provide opportunity, but yet they can never take advantage of them.
Or never display them or, you know, put them and make sure that not only they get – I've seen some of those hoarding episodes where there are things that are buried under piles of trash that have so much meaning and value to a person, and yet it's in terrible shape. It's not displayed on the wall so that they can actually enjoy it.
Right. I, one of the people in one of our studies described it. She said that she's collecting life without living it.
Oh, ouch.
And so she spent all of her time collecting things and never really got to the point of using any of the things she collected.
Dominique, are you a collector? Have you been a collector?
Wow. I have been a collector. I collect photography. I collect pottery, various little things. I collect rocks from the beach. So I do feel my collecting is part of living life rather than a substitution. I'm so fascinated in these hoarding shows. Back to the question you asked at the beginning about why are we in a spasm of guilt or anxiety about our stuff. I think that most people don't come across hoarders. And I think the national attention now that's being paid to what is actually going on in a hoarder's home might be causing anxiety among people who aren't themselves hoarders but worry that they could become that, or are they borderline, or that kind of thing. And maybe that's why the promise of getting rid of things seems like a healthy promise. Maybe that's why there's so much industry now around helping you organize and declutter. I don't know. It's a theory, but I think the look into the world of the hoarder that is possible now compared to even 15 years ago, it's been groundbreaking.
Well, I think that's actually a fascinating point. And Randy Frost, I'd be curious about your response to it. And I mean, you're an expert in hoarding disorder. As I don't know if these shows are still as popular as they used to be, but there was a time where these hoarding shows were pretty popular, part of reality TV. And, you know, as an outsider looking in, pretty shocking and frankly quite sad to see people just buried by their stuff. And obviously in such distress and such pain.
Yeah, it's true, I think the shows are still going pretty strong. I think I seldom watch them anymore, but I think that they had a sort of double-edged effect. On the one hand, it demonstrates that this problem with hoarding disorder itself, is something real. It's not just messiness. It's not just laziness. There's something there. There's some kind of core problem there. On the other hand, it displays a slice of people's lives that, you know, for many people, it just is too intrusive to think about seeing someone in that particular situation. And it goes for they go for emotion in these shows by forcing people to get rid of things and so forth, and don't often get into the real core of what is this disorder, what is going on with them that leads to this behavior.
And do you think, as Dominique is suggesting, that this might be the reason why there are all these magazines and articles and things telling us to get rid of our stuff?
I think so, yeah. I think that probably has made a difference there. And I think, you know, there's also this kind of funny sense of which saying that, well, this is bad. And in truth, you know, the possessions do have a function for all of us, and the function is widespread. It's not only emotional, but it's utility and sort of giving intrinsic value. And so having lots of possessions, there's nothing wrong with someone having a lot of possessions. The difficulty is that breaking point for people with hoarding disorder, where the volume of possessions they have and the way in which they're organized interferes with their ability to live. And that's what crosses over into something more harmful.
Let me read an email from Warren, who says, "Our stuff can be considered a measure of who we are and what we have achieved. Without it, you will not know what you have or what you have not done. Hence, without it, you are nothing." That is a hard thing to get off of or to get over. Dominique, can you relate to what Warren is saying there, which is that our things are a kind of a measure of who we are, what we have accomplished?
They are. They're what sociologists might call signifiers, but they capture history, where we've been, what we've accomplished, if they tend toward that direction, what we've seen, who we've loved. They are definitely a way of displaying history. I don't know if I would go so far as to say without it we're nothing, because I do know people who really very easily give things up. They just don't have that need or desire to have display. They also have enormous closets and lots of places to put things. But still, I do think that our things capture and display and announce to people. I think we've all had the situation of going to somebody's house for the first time, a new acquaintance we might be getting to know, and immediately wandering over to the bookcase to see, well, what does this person read? Or looking at the art on the walls, or looking at, I don't know, diplomas or art, pottery or something like that. You know, we read each other through our things.
Well, we are talking about things on Radio Times with Dominique Browning and also with Randy Frost. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Louise from Norristown to join our conversation. Louise, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to share a story. When my parents passed away and all of the cousins, there were about 10 of them, went to their house to pick out something that they could have from the house, they had the choice of crystal or sterling silver or very fine china. And yet all of them picked much more sentimental items. My one daughter picked a pair of binoculars. My father, you know, used a great deal. My other daughter picked a cheesy vase that my mother put gladiolas in all the time. And I just thought it was so fascinating that, you know, they picked things that all of them thought of and reminded them of their grandparents.
That's a fascinating story, and they didn't pick the silver or the good china or the chandeliers or anything like that.
No, nothing like that. They picked, you know, my one niece picked a table that had been through a storm, but she found, you know, she said, but that's what I really want, is this broken down table.
Well, Louise, I appreciate it. No, it's a great story. Let me give Randy Frost a chance to respond to that. Does that kind of fit your understanding, Randy, of how we think about our things?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because those things are the things that were the key, really, to unlock the memories of that association with the person, the activities with the parents, things the parents used all the time, things the parents were associated with. The silver probably stayed locked in the drawer most of the time, and so it didn't really have that same kind of personal or emotional association.
Dominique, have there been things you have given away that you have regretted?
I've had to go through downsizing myself, so I do know that it is necessary, unless you buy into the storage industry. It is necessary to let go of things. And there are still things that I think, well, I wish I hadn't given that to my sister, or I really wish I hadn't put that into the Goodwill bin. But I did, and I, you know, have fleeting regret. But I also have fleeting regret about things that I saw at a consignment shop and didn't buy. And I think, you know, even 10 years later, oh, rats,
why didn't I get that?
Should have scooped that up.
So what does your sister have that you'd like to get back?
A table. Really love. It was an office table, a desk that I used many, many years that was just too big for my apartment. I'll get it back someday.
Because you know where she lives, right?
Exactly.
How about for you, Randy? Any regrets in this department?
Yeah, not really. I'm sort of a minimalist, although I do, you know, there are some things that I have lots of. I can't think of anything that I passed up and now regret.
What do you have lots of?
I seem to have a lot of shoes.
Oh, you do? Oh, welcome aboard.
And they're not really so for fashion, but for function. So I have a set of shoes for exercise, a set of shoes for the yard, and so forth. And it's hard to let those go because, you know, they're partly it's the same kind of belief system we see in hoarding disorder, not wanting to waste anything and keeping things well beyond their functional utility. Although I think most of my shoes are still functional.
I mean, so you're saying it's raining outside, I'm going to wear these, you know, 30-year-old shoes because I don't care if they get all covered with mud?
Exactly.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Randy Frost and Dominique Browning about our stuff, about our things, about some of the meanings of things that we have collected or accumulated over the years. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Dominique Browning is a writer. She's an author. She's written several books, including most recently one called Slow Love. She had a piece recently in the New York Times. She's also written for the Wall Street Journal, New York Magazine, and for O. And she is the head of Moms Clean Air Force. Randy Frost is a psychology professor at Smith College, wrote a book, co-authored a book a couple of years ago called Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding and the Meaning of Things. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Randy Frost and Dominique Browning about the stuff that we have accumulated over the years, why some things that we have great meaning and great value to us, what to do when we want to try to get rid of it, and if we have regrets about some of the things that we have gotten rid of. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499 to join the conversation. We got a lot of emails here as well. Email address radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read an email from Julie. She says, I found that having less storage common in older homes is a great way to keep from accumulating a lot of occasional use stuff. I also want to ask your guests' opinions about a Japanese method of organizing, Ken Marie method, a Japanese organizer's method for getting rid of all the possessions except those that spark joy. And I wonder, Dominique, if you could respond to that.
Well, yes, I do think it's a good idea. I'm not sure what is exactly Japanese about this method, but there is some idea that you put your hands on everything you have, which would, of course, take me till the end of the century, and you get a feeling about it and decide whether it gives you joy or, I guess, loathing. It is a good idea, I think, not to surround yourself with things that bring up bad memories. And I think we sort of naturally would purge ourselves of those. But the idea that everything around you has to be shouting its meaning to you at every moment, I think would make a cacophony that would bother us. So there are things that I won't look at for a year, and then suddenly we'll turn to a painting I'll walk by a million times and not really look at it, and then I'll turn to it and think, that really is beautiful. I'm so glad I have it.
That's interesting. I want to sort of segue from that, Randy, to something called clutter blindness. And sort of using my own life as an example, there are times I'll be living with stuff, and then, I don't know, a year later I'll look at it and I think, why do I have that? And yet it's been there the whole time. Can you talk a little bit about clutter blindness?
Yeah, we see this most dramatically in people with severe hoarding problems. Let me give you an anecdote of one of the people in one of our treatment studies. And as part of the treatment, I went to her home and worked with her on some of the possessions and the clutter and so forth. And she told me once, she said, you know, when you're not here, I don't notice the clutter and I feel okay. I feel comfortable at home. But when you show up, I notice the clutter and I feel depressed. And when you leave, I feel better. It's not a great place for a therapist to be, but it does reflect something about the nature of the perceptual process that seems to go on, that our homes for someone with a hoarding problem can sometimes become comfortable places. They've habituated to the clutter and so forth, and so they don't notice it. It's really a peculiar thing to see when it happens. But that's a part of it, that all the stuff just seems to be one big piece of my house, and I don't really notice the individual pieces.
Do you think we all have a little piece of that? I mean, that sort of clutter blindness where all of a sudden we think, why do I have this? Why am I living
Absolutely.
With this?
Yeah. You can probably, everyone can probably think of some set of things that are sitting somewhere, maybe even in sight, and you just get used to them being there and you don't notice them until all of a sudden one day you do.
You go, yuck. Let me get David from Central New Jersey to join us on Radio Times. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're very
welcome.
I was
sharing with your screener that my wife's cousin produced a documentary on Edith Wharton for Boston Public Television. But my reading of Edith Wharton, Marty, was that every single object to her was important, and home was the most important of all. So some of the opinions, unless I'm misinterpreting, I don't think anything to Edith Wharton was clutter, and it was a great epiphany for me, reading how everything was important, and home was the spiritual center for a person.
Well, I'm glad you called. And Dominique, as the former editor of House and Garden, can you relate to that?
I certainly can, and Edith Wharton is one of my absolute favorite novelists, and wrote a book, in fact, called The Decoration of Homes, The Decoration of Houses, I think. She wrote a lot about gardens and houses, and she's a great one in her novels for displaying incredible dexterity at letting an object tell you a world about a person. She's terrific at that. So is Charles Dickens, by the way. You know, you learn a lot about the characters in his novels by what's in their rooms and what their rooms look like. And Edith Wharton would certainly have been said to have had many things, but I do believe that they were very, very important to her. She wrote in the mornings in her bed, and she probably sat there looking up from the page and letting her eye rest on a vase or a dish or whatever. So I love bringing Edith Wharton into the conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, David, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Dominique, just sort of segueing off that, do you think we could then think of our homes or our apartments as a museum to us?
They are. They are museums of our own lives. I mean, we all walk around sort of with little movies of who we are in our heads, what the role we're playing. And I do think that our houses are great displays, sometimes open to the public, definitely open to friends and family, and certainly open to ourselves. But I think also they can be poignant places. I have had, in particular, I'm thinking of a friend who worries that she might be a hoarder. And she has said to me, I worry that I I'm looking for things to give me the love that I never had.
Oh, wow.
And that's a very poignant way of thinking and looking for satisfaction and for being loved.
Well, and just picking up on that, Randy, I mean, these objects can function, I guess, as a kind of companion or friend even, or a family.
Yeah, in some cases they do. We just completed a study looking at anthropomorphism in hoarding and people with hoarding problems. And what we find is that people who have struggles with hoarding have a tendency to anthropomorphize their possessions more so than other people do, give them more human-like characteristics. And in that way, it's in conjunction with that, we also found that people with hoarding problems tend to be more lonely than other people. And so it may be that in the loneliness, they turn to these possessions to provide them some kind of emotional balance or emotional support.
Randy, a Facebook comment for you from Allison. She says, thanks for having this expert on hoarding. It's so refreshing to hear someone talk so intelligently and emotionally about what hoarding really is. And I would second that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. A tweet from Samantha. She says that she saves concert event ticket stubs by displaying them under glass on a coffee table. She saved her favorite T-shirt by making it into a quilt, a hashtag declutter. I mean, these are creative ways of displaying and saving our stuff, Dominique.
Speaking of the museum, what
yeah,
a fabulous
exactly.
idea. You know, with those old cabinets of curiosities that people made in the 1800s, 1700s, showing their shells and rocks and insects and taxidermy and just all wonderful ways of displaying the things we love and who we are.
A couple of years ago, I was in London with my husband and we went to Sigmund Freud's office. He lived there really just for about a year until he died. And it was just filled with artifacts and rugs and, you know, apparently a kind of perfect recreation of what it was like to have been Sigmund Freud or perhaps one of his patients, a very provocative and moving place to be. Let me get Miguel from...
I've never seen that. Oh. That is a really, and it's a wonderful, wonderful image. Similarly, I went to a house in California that was made by Ray and Charles Eames, the 50s modernist architect. And you think of 50s modernism as being very spare. Well, it was filled to the brim with textiles and dolls and things from South and Central America, very much like the pictures I've seen of Freud's house.
Interesting. Let me get Miguel from Lawrenceville to join our conversation. Miguel, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. My wife and I have just moved here from St. Louis to New Jersey from, you know, slightly larger house to a smaller apartment. And we just realized we have a lot of stuff that we value, like books, cookbooks and small appliances and dishware that we value but that we just aren't using anymore. So we've decided just to give things away and donate them because stuff that we valued isn't really useful for us anymore, even though we have emotional attachment to them, especially cookbooks and things we've gotten as gifts and stuff like that, things of that or the like.
Is that going to be painful for you, Miguel, for you and your wife?
You know, some things are because we used them and we got them and you know, wedding gifts have been replaced by other things. And, some of it is painful. I will say that.
Well, let me see what Randy Frost says. Randy, any advice for how to shed this stuff or perhaps even mourn the loss of this stuff?
Well, I think the focus here is on the utility of the stuff. And if it's no longer useful, it's really not going to be rewarding at all. It's going to, you know, it might sit in the basement because it feels bad to get rid of it. But in the end, it's not going to bring you any more joy than it already has if you haven't used it. And the utility thing is really quite an interesting distinction, I think, between people who have and don't have a problem with hoarding, because most of us get reinforcement from the use of a possession. When we use it, we enjoy it, and that use reinforces our saving of that object. But if we stop using the object, then we lose that. It loses its reinforcing value, so we're more likely to get rid of it. But for people who struggle with hoarding, what you see is a slightly different pattern of reinforcement, where it is the image or the dream that that object provides. An example, one of the people in the book stuff, Irene, saved cookbooks. And she had 300 cookbooks. She saved every recipe in the newspaper, every magazine with a recipe in it, but she never cooked.
Oh, wow.
But getting rid of them was hard because each time she looked at a cookbook or a recipe, she thought to herself how wonderful it would be to have a dinner party for all of her friends and use this recipe. And the thought of getting rid of it was, to her, it felt like the dying of that dream. So that what was reinforcing to her was the dream that these possessions allowed her to dream, the fantasy, the potential identity that it gave her, even though it was never used, it was never put into practice. But so the reinforcement pattern was a little bit different.
Miguel, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Good luck to you as well. You can call Radio Times at No, that's not the phone number. The phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We're talking about our possessions with Randy Frost and with Dominique Browning. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me read an email from David. He says, I immediately went in my personal clutter room, threw out a pile of book reviews that I'm never going to get to, and took an armload of books downstairs headed for the barn. So it looks like Dominique and Randy, we inspired someone to go and declutter a little bit. Let me get Nancy from Shanesville to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I have a few policies that I go by. I say to myself, how much is enough? That's one thing. And just because I like it, I don't have to buy it. And then when it comes to gifts from the children, I'm 69 years old, and I tell my daughter, if I can't wear it and I can't eat it, I don't want it. And my daughter does make my grandson watch hoarders when his room gets messy. And then he gets all wild and wound up, and then he cleans his room.
Really? I've never heard it quite used that way. Well, Nancy, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Dominique, you want to say anything in response?
I love the rule. Just because I like it, it doesn't mean I have to buy it. And that is a very good rule to stop impulsive spending. At least wait 24 hours and see if you still really like it. I also like the idea of giving things away to family, to friends, especially if you're downsizing. But something else I've seen start to happen maybe happening all over the country, and that is people setting up bookcases, either in restaurants or at coffee houses, with free books. You can take one if you want to read it and leave one if you want to give one away. So that might be another option instead of having to deal with secondhand book dealers who aren't going to give you anything for your books anyway or filling the barn. Bring them to a cafe or a coffee house and say, let's start a giveaway pile.
Randy, what do you think of the idea of using an episode of Hoarders to get a young person to clean their room?
Well, I don't know how well it would work across the board, but I'm sure it does lead people to think, oh, I better do something. I frequently get the question when I do talks and workshops and things from people about themselves. Do I have a hoarding problem? And for the most part, most of the time, people are concerned if they have a hoarding problem if they've got some clutter. But really, that the major issue here is the extent to which the clutter interferes with the living spaces and prevents their use in the way in which they were designed. And that's really the key characteristic. So people whose attics are full, basements are full, storage units are full, doesn't really qualify as hoarding because their living spaces allow them to live without impairment.
Randy Frost, thanks so much for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. He's a professor of psychology at Smith College, co-author of a book that came out a couple of years ago called Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding, and the Meaning of Things. Dominique Browning, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
It was fun for us as well. She's a writer, an author, and we read a piece that she had in the New York Times about clutter and her stuff, and that got us thinking about this particular show. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this show, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens with Sophie Reed this week. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.